We heard yesterday that Michaela McCullum Connolly and Melissa Reid could face up to 3 years in a Peruvian prison before their case is even heard in court. Are the two young women drug mules, or are the young women forced by powerful drug dealers to smuggle large quantities of cocaine from Peru back to their temporary home, the so-called Fun Island of Ibiza? Well, Daniel Briggs is a reader in criminology and criminal justice at the University of East London. He's done extensive research on the British and indeed the Irish tourist who goes to Ibiza for something of a lifestyle explosion. Daniel, good morning to you. What has created and then fueled this culture specifically in Ibiza?
Goodness me. Well, it must have started probably in the 60s when you had, Ibiza became known as a bit of a hippie retreat, but once sort of dance and house music evolved in the 80s, it became a bit of a commercial enterprise. And really that's what's happened since, is that the more people have sort of descended on the island to hit the super clubs, the more global corporations and marketing experts have sort of realised, yeah, we can make a bit of money out of this. And what we've seen in the last 10 years, specifically in Ibiza, is a loss of tourism. So the sort of super clubs and these marketing experts are wanting to generate profit and ensure that people go and spend as much as they can when they go there. So how do they do that? Well, they increase the marketing of the island to young people, probably like the two girls we see in this particular case.
Now, this particular case obviously has made huge headlines in this country, but yeah, you must have seen this kind of thing many, many times before.
Yeah, I mean, I spent a couple of summers in Ibiza writing my book, talking and interviewing young people who, you know, perhaps out there for a holiday, or even young people have fallen into drug dealing networks. Young people specifically gone out to Ibiza to deal drugs. And, it's not... I don't think it's unusual for, you know, young people to go there and do those things. What is unusual, and this case seems quite extreme, is for them to somehow end up in Peru on drug trafficking charges. I mean, we don't know. I can't really sort of shed any more light on this, how precisely they did get from Ibiza to Peru, but I can certainly say something how people like them arrived in Ibiza.
Well, tell us about that what you can say.
Yes, I mean, I think we have to look really less at how young people are lured to Ibiza, but more how the island is marketed to them about, you know, some sort of part of their leisure life which they should be living, and they need to maximise their youth and their leisure time by, you know, partying 24/7 on a holiday. And, for a lot of young people, when they go to these resorts like San Antonio, which is where these two girls were working, It's you know, the good life is on tap, and it's suddenly home life appears quite overcast. You know, they don't really enjoy their jobs back home, or maybe they're studying and the degree looks a little bit boring. And suddenly, you know, this sort of euphoria could be something quite tempting that they could permanently live, as in they could come back later in the summer or even become a casual worker and permanently live the dream. And this is when things can get a little bit dodgy, really, when people start sacrificing what they have or haven't got at home and throw themselves into this excessive consumption, mass spending, get themselves into debt because they want to sort of enjoy the party. And that's what they've kind of been sort of socialized into and commercially duped into. And that, unfortunately, drug dealing becomes a potential option to top up wages or even to sustain themselves.
And in relation to the marketing that you're talking about, is there a kind of a nudge-nudge attitude to the illegal side of the good life? Is that implicit in the way in which Ibiza is marketed?
Yeah, I think so, really. I mean, the super clubs, they pretty much know that on one hand they are, you know, marketing their music and the style, the aesthetic of the club, the brand of the club, but they know that when people, young people come, that they will be using drugs in the club. And what I find quite ironic is that there have been some sort of harm reduction in these super clubs to reduce the risk of young people collapsing on overdosing in drugs, you know, by providing water, but the super clubs charge €10 for a bottle of water. So They're really not interested in people's safety whatsoever. They're interested in making as much money out of people as possible.
You've got a couple of different categories of people that you're talking about. You've got the people who go there for a week or a fortnight every year, and then you've got what you describe as the casual workers. How much can you make? Obviously, if you are only going there for 2 weeks a year and you are in employment, you can save enough money and you know, you can have a good time and you spend a lot of money. If you're a casual worker and you're there on a permanent or semi-permanent basis, how much can you earn? How much would you spend in living this 24/7 party life?
Well, I mean, to basically give up whatever you have and go and sort of try and live this dream in San Antonio is probably not the best idea, because there's so many people trying to pursue the same sort of dream. I'll give you an example. Last summer, the local police said that they had 3,000 casual workers registered on their books, just registered, because obviously you can expect other people just turn up and find work. But only 1,000 of those young people had work. So there's a couple of thousand people, young people in Ibiza, who have basically got one-way tickets looking for work of some sort. And, you know, this work isn't pretty. It's not ideal. It's, you'd be lucky if it pays 10 or 15 euros a day. Most of it's commission only. The wages obviously are poor. The treatment's poor. There's no job security. So, I mean, really, it becomes a very easy thing to sort of get into the network of drug dealing, because, you know, it can give you an extra 100 euros a day and obviously some drugs on top of that for you. And, you know, within this, once you get into these, immersed into these casual networks, a lot of the casual workers live together in apartments or dedicated hotels or villas or whatever, then, you know, that's when it can get pretty dangerous, because you are just living this 24/7 lifestyle. And that's, you know, when I've seen some young people lose their jobs and fallen into significant debt, and obviously without commenting too much on this particular case, but it's when you're in debt to drug dealers that there are potential problems. I mean, I know that passports can be withdrawn and threats can be made. And that's certainly been, I mean, I remember talking to one guy who had become homeless after being only 3 days in Ibiza. He'd spent £2,000. He's walking the streets limping. He had half his ear bitten off by a bouncer. And, you know, he sort of come out of there with this puss in boots attitude to be a casual worker. But, you know, had no flight home, didn't know where the consulate was, and, you know, had really little alternative but to probably try and find some sort of illegal way of sustaining himself.
And the stereotype is that they then fall into the clutches of a Mr. Big. Is it as dramatic as that, or is it a little bit more banal?
Well, I wouldn't say. I mean, the way drug dealing networks are configured on the island, I'm not sure how they're organised. I think the media like to believe in Mr. Big and the evil cartels and how they prey on vulnerable young women. Obviously, we can't, you know, it's not to say it doesn't happen, but it's a story the media like. But, you know, from what I've seen in my research, it's more loose groups of young people that sort of come to Ibiza to deal, or even individual entrepreneurs that, you know, come to Ibiza plugged up, really. So it's and a lot of that, and even I think the BBC have tried to do some investigation as well. And, you know, it's more sort of from Britain to Ibiza, but the connection does seem strange that to South America, you know, so, you know, these big Peruvian cartels, and you kind of wonder, well, yeah, how did that happen, if it did happen?
We heard from somebody on this programme earlier in the week who had ended up being being banged up in jail for importing or attempting to export, I suppose, drugs. His point was that he suspected that he was a mule, obviously, and he had volunteered. He'd done it voluntarily. He had done it to make some money, and he didn't have any qualms about that. And he didn't have any qualms, I suppose, in one sense, about the fact that he had been caught and that he had been jailed. He didn't feel victimized particularly. But what he did think was, and what he did say was, that he suspected that he was a drug mule who had been essentially turned into a sacrificial lamb, that the airport police had been directed to him because he had 5 kilos of cocaine, while other people were getting through with much larger amounts. Did you come across any evidence of that, anecdotally or otherwise?
No, I've not in my research. I mean, my book is focused really on the behaviours of the tourists and touched in some detail on the casual workers and drug dealing. But if we're talking about The kind of drug distribution you're talking about, I couldn't really qualify any further.
Okay, in your research for the book, and it's called, by the way, Deviance and Risk on Holiday, an ethnography of British tourists in Ibiza. It's published by Paul Grave and Macmillan. In the research for the book, you met up with a group of people called the Southside Crew.
Yeah.
You did that fairly early on. They sound like a pretty rough lot. Tell us a little bit about the Southside Crew.
They've essentially grown up in the south of England, got quite accustomed to, you know, drinking and taking drugs, I think like most young people in the UK, from an early age. Some got quite heavily into drug dealing, cocaine dealing. A couple of them, I think, sort of shifting kilos and making a substantial amount of money. They'd done time for various offences, GBH1, cocaine dealing as well. So they probably didn't have the cleanest of backgrounds, but I suspect that there's a fair few people with similar backgrounds that go to San Antonio. So it is a class issue. We are talking about class tastes and how particular a class of young people enjoy their leisure time in San Antonio. If you imply it in Bossa, you don't have the same sort of class. You have more of a seasoned Ibiza goer or middle-class tourist.
And did you encounter any actual violence? Were the Southside Crew, were they capable of violence? Did they get involved in it?
No, it's more sort of playful deviance and risk. I witnessed sort of fights and things like that, and ambulances turning up to people who look fairly delirious or people who are literally in piles looking as if they've been in a car crash. But the kind of violence that these young people, the Southside Crew, would sort of distribute on a weekend night out wasn't really apparent during their holiday. I think they were more intent on basically spending as much money as they had and doing quite sordid things, really.
And what was the difference in behaviour between the working class, good timers, and the more middle class or the better off tourists?
That's a good question, but the strange thing is it's such a sort of same sort of thing, really.
But just in a different location.
Well, it is, and it's just that the higher class grading would like to think that they do it better off because they can afford a nicer place in which to do it. I'll give you an example. On Ibiza, you have two private hotels, one called Ushuaia and one called Ibiza Rocks. And Ibiza Rocks is based in San Antonio, and this is where you're much more of a working class cohort would go, but Ushuaia is marketed at the sort of middle to upper bracket. But essentially, they're contained zones for excessive consumption, spending on drugs, alcohol, partying. I mean, they do the same thing, but they function very differently for a different sort of class of tourist. So, and they permit, that's the crucial thing, they permit these behaviours to occur because money is being earned.
How does social media affect the way people behave on holiday now, young people behave on holiday?
Massively. With the advent of things like Facebook and YouTube, a lot of these young people are looking to create social envy for what they do. They want people to talk about them and the kind of crazy things they did. So it may involve them doing things like planking or jumping off balconies or recording them drunk or doing stupid things, and then they'll put them on Facebook or something like YouTube. And that really, it sort of comes down to what I was saying to you earlier about how young people are sort of socially and commercially endorsed into thinking that their youth should be spent doing new, different, crazy things, much like the MasterCard advert, priceless. Experiences are priceless. Well, not so priceless when you get the online bill through, eh?
And would you suspect that if Facebook, YouTube and all of that didn't exist, that these people wouldn't necessarily be compelled to do the kind of things that they do?
I think Facebook and YouTube play a part, but I still think as a way of exploring time out from perhaps fairly what these young people describe as mundane existences back home, you still get similar sort of behaviours. The level or perhaps the extremity to which then may be questioned, because obviously people like to do risky things to be able to talk about it. It can become legendary, and it just reminds me of these actually five Irish girls that I interviewed 5 hours after they'd been beaten up by nightclub bouncers. And I was interviewing them as they were having breakfast. And I said, "What happened to you?" And they showed me these cuts and bruises and everything. And, they were really upset, really sort of disturbed because they'd been in the police cells as well. And And I said, well, you know, and they started laughing after about half an hour of the interview. And I said, why are you laughing? You've just been beaten up by bouncers, etc. And you show me all these cuts and bruises. Well, I said, yeah, but it's really funny. And, you know, one said, I've already thought of my Facebook status, and I thought about it while I was in the police car. And that Facebook status was, you know, already been in Ibiza, molested and beaten up. So, you know, it's the kudos, even though that there's a tragedy in the end, in the event, it's the kudos that comes with being talked about. And that's just an example.
And finally, did you speak to many locals about how the tourist economy affects them? Did you speak to law enforcement about how the tourist economy affects them?
Yeah, absolutely. I did interviews with the local police, with local residents and business owners, and they're... What you've seen in San Antonio over the last 15, 20 years is it become more of a mono-tourism zone. So it's much more young British-oriented rather. And a lot of the Italian, Scandinavian and Spanish tourism firms have sort of dissipated from the area. Why is that? Because, well, those tourists don't really like the sort of things that British do all day, which is drink all day and take drugs, etc. So really, it leaves the local businesses in a kind of, well, not, very little choice other than if they want to stay in business, open up a bar, open up a cafe offering fried breakfast. So, you know, the resort just grows to cater for more British, if you like.
Daniel, thanks very much indeed for talking to us this morning. Daniel Briggs is the author of Deviance and Risk on Holiday and Ethnography of British Tourists in Ibiza. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. It's also available from Amazon.